when I think back on it, it became exciting. And so this thing was really moving, and there was people that were everything from ecstatic to upset, and everything in between.
Everything in between.
Everything in between.
Welcome to the 354th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. The first time I saw Jay Fear in action, he was tramping through a diverse planting of cover crops in south central North Dakota and inviting some 120 farmers to do the same. They were hesitant to crush such a verdant stand of green plants in a region that often suffers from lack of precipitation. Take a closer look. Anything you tramp down is just carbon in the soil, said Fear as he began spading up soil samples. Since then, I've talked to Jay several times and have always been struck by two things. First, that he's unwilling to accept our soil as a degraded resource. In his opinion, we have the ability to not just conserve or sustain it, but to improve it. What's also impressed me about Jay is that he's one of these people who did a bit of a pivot in his career as a soil conservationist. During the first part of his tenure with the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, Jay was pretty conventional in his approach. He would visit farmers, see that they had a problem, and prescribe practices and structures that basically put a band-aid on the symptoms that were resulting from a farming system based on bare soil, intense tillage, monocrops, and lack of biological activity. Jay went on to be instrumental in developing the Burley County Soil Health Team. This team, which was made up of farmers such as Gabe Brown, along with scientists and natural resource agency professionals like Jay, played a key role in launching the current soil health movement we're experiencing in this country and beyond. Over the years, scores of farmers and soil conservationists have traveled to the Bismarck area to tour farms that were regenerating their soil and to take a look at the research being done at the Monocan Farm, a soil health demonstration site operated by the Burley County Soil Conservation District. These days, Jay divides his time between working at the Monocan Farm and providing training and demonstrations related to building soil health. As part of that latter work, I ran into him this summer at the northeastern Minnesota farm of John and Karen Stevens. During a Minnesota Soil Health Coalition field day the Stevenses hosted, Jay described ways of monitoring soil health and took folks on a pasture walk. It turns out Jay had visited the same farm 7 years ago, and, as we describe in Ear to the Ground 353, he was blown away by the improvements the Stevenses have made to their soil since that first visit. The conservationist says the Stevens farm is a prime example of an operation that's regenerated its land, following the soil health principles of armoring the surface, minimizing disturbance, increasing plant diversity, providing continuous living root systems, and integrating livestock. After the field day, I sat down with Jay next to one of the Stevens' fields to talk about the beginnings of the initiative in Burley County and how it was influenced by history, holistic management, and the latest breakthroughs in soil science. What's refreshing about Jay is that despite his optimism about the ability of the soil health movement to revitalize agriculture, he's also quite frank about the realities we face. Despite the soil health gains he's witnessed by visiting farms like the Stevens's, the veteran conservationist is quite troubled by the backward steps we're taking on a region-wide basis as the current cropping system becomes more entrenched. Jay also shared why, on a day years ago when he first started talking about a different approach to soil conservation with his colleagues, he ended up eating lunch alone.
So I initially started out treating symptoms, and I think that's an easier start because they're, from a human aspect, they're so much easier to see and identify. And we can get really good at that because it's well defined. Mm-hmm. And so you can develop a skill set to do that. But the missing item for me was any fulfillment from the human aspect, something that you looked at with maybe some pride or maybe some fulfillment that said, this is very satisfying in my life and it feels right. And I was missing that element. And so I still recall the day very vividly. I got up in front of my peers at a NRCS meeting, and previously I had asked for, you know, if I could speak to the group And I was told we will give you 5 minutes before lunch. And I said, I'll take it. And 5 minutes before lunch, I spoke to my peers and I said, we're starting to look at writing descriptions for soil health principles. And I said, they talk about things like soil aggregates. They talk about things like carbon. And I said, they're things I don't know a lot about, but I'm learning about them. And I'm asking others to teach me on them. And so it started the whole process right there for mentors. And so the interesting thing was it got so quiet in the group. Nobody asked a question. Nobody said anything positive or negative. It was just a little strange. And I always end this story by saying, yes, I did have lunch alone that day. But it was the start. And you have to start somewheres. And for me, it was important that it was like I wanted a beginning line. And so that was my beginning line. And so I went down kind of a road of self-education and mentorship education. And I learned how to do how to look at carbon cycles, carbon and carbon cycles, how to look at cropping systems, what builds these aggregates, what moves a carbon needle, what difference does it make if I tilled or didn't till? What does a bricks level do? What do all these things? How do we improve a soil? Because really at that time the classical thought was you're not going to build a soil. This is that 1,000-year scenario, and the 1,000-year scenario is more sand, silt, and clay degrading from the Rockies. Okay, that's kind of what I look at more as the 1,000-year scenario, but we can impact carbon in a much quicker time frame. And we can bring life in. And so I went on a reading quest as well. I've always enjoyed reading, but I started being a little more selective. And I started looking at documents, Lewis and Clark, just an example, but I started looking at documents of what built our soils. And it was such a fascinating adventure. And when you start reading about people like Eldo Leopold and all these different people that looked at nature in a unique manner, And so it started my road down this rebuilding and adding life, and it started to be fulfilling.
And it sounds like maybe, too, at the same time, what you were seeing, kind of what you were promoting and other people like you were promoting, wasn't really working, too. It wasn't kind of what we're doing isn't working, no matter how much more we double down on doing it.
Well, so at that particular time, so I started in the 1980s. Started in 1980, actually. And so in 1980s, our erosion rates in the Northern Plains, North Dakota specifically, they were what I would call sky high. And so we also had water erosion. That's why I was building all these structures, treating symptoms. When our problem was, we couldn't get the water into the profile. And so we had a degraded soil, and now we were trying to make all these different changes by treating the symptoms. And so that was kind of the start of that process of rebuilding and putting life into the soil. And that led me down a road of meeting some of the most fascinating people, and they were all energized. And you felt right about it. It felt like the right road. So I was always happy I made that road. You know, when you do that, I mean, you know, if I'm just being real honest with you, not everybody that you're working with is comfortable with that, okay? Maybe management's looking at you a little differently, or maybe your peers are looking at you a little differently. So it was real important that I had family support. So our children, my wife, everyone was fully in. Everyone supported me.
Speaking of working with folks, the other thing that struck me was when I first started learning what was going on in Burley County was it almost seemed like a perfect storm in that you had a really good team there of farmers, scientists, other agency folks that were just interested in kind of regenerating that resource. It sounds like that team effort was key, because if you had just been pushing this on your own, or even if you had a couple really all-star farmers that were really pushing it, it probably wouldn't have gone anywhere.
It's not the same. No, you're exactly right. And so we did form a team, and we did self-educate together. And so it kind of evolved around the Burley Soil District Board of Supervisors, and then the NRCS office staff and the SCD office staff. we were mingled together. You didn't know one of us from another, okay? And we all worked on the same projects together. And so we formed this team. We self-educated. We would pick out topics. Mm-hmm. And of course, initially it was easier to pick them out because they started with the dynamic soil properties. Well, these are the ones that you can change with management. And so these are the ones you want to start with when you look at soil health principles. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of built around those, okay? And so we started in that regard. And you're exactly right. So with the team and the meeting of the team and like-mindedness of the team, you felt you had a place to sit down and talk about what was and wasn't working. And if it wasn't working, why wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And what do we need to change? And let's do that. So we did.
Like, roughly when was this? When was that? What year roughly was that? Things kind of really changing for you and for this, when was this team getting together? I always was curious about that.
So I think it was starting to evolve in the late 80s. So the 80s were really the frustration period. So really super high erosion rates, and we had a lot of degradation in terms of our resource. And so that was really the 80s, and the 80s set the stage for this. And then as we got toward the end of the 80s, we started evolving and started putting this team together. And so that was kind of, it's like I had to get beat down a bit first.
Yeah.
And then, in order to get traction, and in order to know you were actually hitting in the right direction.
You were talking about the five soil health principles.
Right.
Did that come out of, did you guys invent that?
No. Nope.
Where did that
no.
get come out of?
No, so the principles, I think, if you read Gabe Brown's book, I think he probably described it best. He said nature wrote the principles. So what we did and what I did specifically for NRCS was I wrote descriptions of the principles. Because at first we just had the term, just the principle. Okay, well then you ask yourself, what does that mean?
Right.
And so you have a vague sense, but you don't know exactly what it all entails. And I'll give you an example. So the one that really evolved for me was the one on disturbance. Okay, so initially, disturbance, well, that was physical disturbance with tillage. Okay, so that's where I kind of started with it.
Right.
And my first description's probably centered on that. But the most recent one I wrote on it, which was rather recent, it's also biological disturbance, which means less photosynthetic time, less plant diversity, etc. And then it was also chemical disturbance. And so we can't, it's not realistic thought to think that we can continue to apply real high rates of all the pesticides continually and real high rates of a commercial fertility with no carbon in it but a high salt reference in it. And so we have to address these things from that viewpoint. And so I think disturbance changed. I shouldn't say changed. It evolved and got added to and expanded. And we started to understand that probably the biological disturbance is as big or bigger than even physical disturbance. So that would be a point. But I would say when we got into the 90s, we started gaining tractions on it. And so it became, when I think back on it, it became exciting. And so this thing was really moving, and there was people that were everything from ecstatic to upset, and everything in between.
Everything in between.
But yet a lot of enough support and movement that you knew this road was the right direction.
Yeah. It seems like that this was very much influenced by holistic management. Is that true?
It is very much influenced by holistic management. I took the holistic management course in 1986 in Bismarck from Alan Savory. And so he came to Bismarck, taught the class. I attended the class. And I met some people there that became lifelong people, associates, that you could discuss all these principles with. And so it was the first time I attended something where I said to myself, well, how can that person say that?
Yeah.
So because it was so contrary to conventional thinking. And then later in the day, I'm like, oh, I think he just said it again. but he brought out, and more in a principled manner, which I appreciated, different aspects that we're dealing with. Started with grazing systems with them. And then 30 years later, we brought them back to Bismarck. And we had a three-day session with him. Still a brilliant mind, just one of the great thinking minds for sure.
Well, and the reason I bring that up is I remember going on a field day tour there in Burleigh County, and the issue of quality of life was brought up repeatedly by both the farmers and folks like you. And I was like, okay, this really is starting to smell like holistic management, where it's not just the health of the soil or the health of your bottom line, it's also the health of the family, and that kind of piece all is part of a whole kind of thing.
Yeah, so we ended up adding a holistic resource management coordinator, if you will, to our team. And so that was Joshua Dukart at the time, and gave us that human aspect. And we started thinking about things, I'll use the term purpose-driven life. We started looking at that differently. And we started seeing the need for those things and how you as a human being react differently when you have that in your life. Because I had experienced it personally. Yeah. So I knew exactly what he was saying because I could relate to it.
And going back a little bit to this, because I am just fascinated by this, the other thing that always struck me was, and this fit in with a lot of the work Land Stewardship Project's been doing with farmers here, in that instead of taking the old route of you've got the expert coming from the university or from the government kind of handing down information from on high, the farmers were seen as experts too, and they were often leading, and it was kind of a real give and take, and farmers were coming to folks like you or to scientists and saying, I'm seeing this thing go on and I don't understand why, can you help me figure this out? And it really was a kind of a team effort rather than I've got this expertise, here's the way it's going to be a cookie cutter solution kind of thing.
Yep. I think you're exactly on, and that's correct. And one of those items that we addressed with farmers on the ground was what we think of now, pretty straightforward, and that is what moves the carbon needle and soil organic matter levels. And so as we applied these principles, we saw this acceleration of soil organic matter gains, to which we were told that that's not possible,
right,
and that is not correct. But as we came further down the road, and we started getting into better understanding of the carbon cycle from the viewpoint of exudates, mm-hmm, which was kind of a missing portion back in the 80s. Not that it maybe wasn't known in some scientific worlds, but it wasn't commonly discussed in the ag community at all.
Right.
And so it was definitely a missing part. And so as that came into place, all of a sudden the science was there to support what we were seeing. And I felt comfortable in what we were seeing because I took the tests myself. I took those tests, and before and after, I had that data. And so we stood on that data, but it wasn't popular.
Right. And that's where, like you said, you needed family to kind of support you some of those dark nights. So you've been involved with this since 1980. You kind of, the late 80s, started to kind of view things differently. I have been around long enough, I remember the soil quality movement, and,
right,
and there's been just soil conservation in general, that kind of thing. I've been really struck by, I think, the soil health movement. I don't know if I want to call it a revolution. Maybe we can call it a revolution. I don't know if you're comfortable with that. But kind of this phase that we're in right now really has legs. Like, I'm seeing it. It is infiltrating so much of the regenerative ag movement, and I'm seeing more and more quote-unquote conventional farmers kind of look into it. What are some of the trends that you have seen over the years? And I guess, did you think that it would become kind of this movement, or did you, yeah, I just was curious what kind of the trends that you've seen over the years?
So if we go back a little bit, when I started, conservation tillage was the term.
Yeah.
And so I started with that. And it was always a very difficult term for me because it had very little to do with conservation. It had a lot to do with tillage,
yeah,
and different aspects of it. And we micro-analyze that to death, right? And so that was a term, kind of a generic term.
Soil
and
tilth was a big thing.
Yep, the word tilth was a big item, yep. And so, you had all these things. Then after that, we changed terms. We had organizations like Manitoba North Dakota Zero Till Association show up, and they were a big influence in the 80s and early 90s. And we came up with words like no-till. And so that was a term that was thrown on to a lot of different systems. Sometimes it fit, sometimes it didn't. The weak point on it probably never was well-defined or described exactly what this means, because it's rather generically used anymore. It was never really one of my favorite terms either, because it was just about the seeding operation. It didn't talk much about carbon. It didn't talk about much all these things. And when NRCS moved into, I think we had the name change in 94, if I remember right, from SCS to NRCS. But the interesting thing I remember was the posters. And the poster for no-till came out from NRCS. And it had some change laying on a table, and it had an hourglass. And you as the farmer, the message was, you as a farmer, we're going to move into no-till to save time and money.
Yeah.
And it had absolutely nothing to do with carbon or soil aggregates or nutrient density, or it had nothing to do with those aspects.
Yeah.
And we tried two or three big pushes internally within the agency to try to make that thing move, but it wouldn't move. And the main reason it wouldn't move is we didn't understand diversity. And so we had no understanding of that, and we had no understanding of how big this topic was and how interconnected. We were just dealing with one small little aspect of it. Well, then from there, we started moving into the term soil health. And soil health was a term that worked because no matter who heard it, they knew what it was. And so I really think that's the big difference between soil quality and soil health. Soil quality came out of an aspect that really needed an interpreter, and it needed somebody to explain what soil quality is, how it functioned, how it worked. And soil health kind of eventually became that. So you were looking at a scenario then with the principles and the description of the principles. And so that then eventually kind of moved into more of a regeneration type scenario, because I think everyone by then had a pretty good understanding that, hey, we're building back. We're going to build this back, right?
Right.
And so that kind of came in the whole regeneration thing. And so I think terms are kind of inevitable. I think different periods of time have different terms. And so I don't look at them as a pro or a con or anything else. I just look at them as that's that term that we're using during this 10, 20-year period here.
Right.
You know, and it'll change again.
Well, and I remember sustainable ag was the big thing for a long time. And I remember, I don't know when this was, but I was at a field day, and a farmer said, I don't want to just sustain the system, I want to regenerate it. And it was this idea of I can use soil health to improve it rather than just maybe sustaining a certain plateau that I've gotten to, and it's kind of a continuum. We can get better and better and better. And I thought, oh, this is a little different viewpoint than what I've been hearing.
That was the different viewpoint, but it was not just in the farming community that was having those conversations. Those conversations were happening internally within NRCS too. That right now, you know, the people that were working on symptoms, they were looking at conserving. And they weren't looking at rebuilding or regeneration,
yes, right.
And they weren't looking at it from the viewpoint of the health of the ecosystem. And so therein lied that dilemma, not just in the farming community, but internally within USDA as well. And, you know, initially I think there was a fair bit of pushback maybe in both entities, but eventually I think both saw that, no, we're probably not going to stop this. We have to understand it and apply it. So my personal goal has always been to farm forever. So if we're going to farm forever, you have to put these things into the best position that you can adjust and improve upon, for sure.
So are you seeing more farmers adopting some of these practices over time and seeing some the results?
So we initially saw a lot of adaptation of physical disturbance, especially that principle. You know, we've had we definitely, and I'm talking about Northern Plains now. We definitely have less tillage than we used to have. So that's a positive. We have some adoption of covers. That's a positive in terms of planting green for pintos and soybeans, etc. And so those are some positive things. The main operating system, I feel, still hasn't really changed. I think that's still there. And so that part I would like to see some improvement upon.
Well, how would you describe, what is that main operating system?
So a main operating system in the Northern Plains would be limited crop diversity. So corn, bean, soybean is the number one crop now in the Dakotas. Mm-hmm. So we took wheat out, and you say, well, that's just switching one out for the other, but it's more than that. Because when we took wheat out, we took the high carbon plant out. Mm. We took the one out that could build aggregates and give you enough residue to last until you had a green plant growing again. And we replaced it with a plant that might be well-meaning to do that, but doesn't have the capabilities of a wheat plant to do that. It doesn't have the plant characteristics necessary. And so those are scenarios that in our environment have evolved into what I would call wind erosion in no-till systems. And that sounds strange at this point in our juncture, because at one time, I think we had that quite well stabilized,
yeah.
But we had better diversity then. We still had some wheat, mm-hmm. and we had some beans, we had some corn, we had some sunflower, canola. These were all crops, and so we had some pretty good diversity, and we had a pretty stable scenario. And now the frequency of the low-carbon crop has increased dramatically. The frequency of the high-carbon crop has dropped dramatically. This has made a difference on our landscape. This is significant. To me, it's concerning. It's something that we need to address because you can't tolerate when you're looking at erosion. And this was an item that NRCS and I never agreed on, was a tolerance level for erosion. Mm. Well, really, that's a political level. That's not a real level.
It's not
a landscape or ecological level. On this farm we were on today, when I put the spade in the ground and looked at that particular perennial with the livestock, it's building. It's not losing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's way beyond that scenario, and that's what we have to be thinking of.
Yeah.
So that when we have a cropland field, like this cornfield that's pretty close by here, when you walk into that cropland field and you put the spade in the ground, I see soil aggregates, I see life, because he's supplied all that. And so it's a different environment, but if we're going to have frequency of a plant that isn't capable of building soil aggregates, and it is very low carbon, very low amounts of armor on the soil surface, that's going to impact us. And in our big scale ag country in the Dakotas, where the wind is, there's nothing to stop it. And so we definitely are going to be impacted and have been.
Yeah, so you're seeing more erosion, that type of thing?
Yeah, I think we're seeing more. We probably had a golden period, maybe coming into the early 2000 to 2010 might have been our utopia period.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And then when we got past 10 and we started seeing much more frequency change in the cropping patterns, that's when I think we really noticed the erosion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess we're just looking at this thing pretty honestly. It appears as though we've also kind of hardened in a bit to it.
It's
something we can't tolerate and build the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And people look at and want to know how to build carbon levels for voluntary carbon credits or whatever. Well, first thing that has to be addressed is erosion rates. You can't have that. And so, you know, if we can bring our erosion rates down for wind and water, and if we can improve our water quality and quantity, I think then one time one of my mentors told me, after that, get as fancy as you want to.
Well, speaking of, you were referring to this farm that we're on here, and you were here 7 years ago, and I think that's really an important insight that you can provide, in that you were able to then come back today, and you were here yesterday, I know, and kind of dug up some soil and did a little walking around. What have you seen on this farm here? They're doing crops, but they also have got a nice rotational grazing system going here. What have you seen? How is it different from 7 years ago?
What I'm really seeing from 7 years ago, overall, and I'm talking about the farm in general here, the bar has been raised on soil health on this farm. So I think they've done a really good job of connecting the cropping system and the grazing system together. And so they've got multiple species of perennials, and they are grazing them with ruminants. And then you are looking at daily moves. And so when you're looking at that environment and they're just topping it, right? So they're just topping, taking the higher protein and energy portion of the plant, trampling out the other portion. And so within a few years, you can see some pretty dramatic changes in carbon and just life in general. And then, of course, now we got fields that are out now. They've come out the other end of that system, and they're in cropland. And so we had a chance now to get on those, and those are looking remarkable.
Yeah.
And so what he has is a nice connection of the systems. And so when you have a weak link, right, in a field or somewhere on a farm, and you can come in with the perennial aspect, that's a huge item. And they've really done a nice job on it, and it's just raised the general level on the farm. Yeah. It's definitely caught my eye right away.
Kind of on the macro level, some of the trends aren't so hot that we're seeing. Like you said, we're kind of hardened into a certain system, but on a farm-by-farm basis, we're seeing some pretty exciting stuff.
I think that's the hope, right? That's the shining light at the end of the tunnel, because we have farms like that, and those farms are in every state. And so I can't tell you how many I've had the opportunity to be on over the years, and these are people that they get the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. They understand that the nutrient needs to stay on that farm and not leave it on a water course. And they get these items, yeah, and they address these items, and they care about these items. Yeah. And I think that's why we're all optimistic about it, and yeah, and I think we should be. And I think then it becomes how do we broaden that out? And so that's a great question, but I think that's a very real item, and we definitely see that.
It sounds like you've talked John out of using the moldboard plow next year.
Well, I guess we'll find out. Yeah. When we got onto the cropland field, first year cropland that was in a managed grazed perennial, okay, and we got the spade in the ground and took a look at that soil, and you could see the life in it and the aggregates in it. And it definitely, I think, caught both their attention, at least I hope it did, and it appeared to be that way. And so when you see it, and you see it on your own field, in your own land, from your own efforts, yeah, that's pretty significant.
Well, I overheard him tell a couple of his neighbors, yeah, I guess I'm not using the plow next year. So I think he's convinced a little bit. Well, and you get to come back. It's kind of must be neat to come back to a farm after being here 7 years ago and seeing the changes.
Maybe 7 years from now we can look at it again.
For more on building soil health profitably, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 354 at landstewardshipproject.org. There you also find a link to the podcast I did recently with John Stevens and the original articles I wrote over a decade ago on the Burley County Soil Health Team. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendale, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.